This is Michael Shaw. Before we get to the Carter Mall episode, I wanted to remind you that a Kickstarter, that is a crowdfunding campaign for the Conversation Three-Way, the next phase of the conversation, the new and exciting phase, which will take place hopefully as soon as May. And that means contributions are still very welcome. The Kickstarter ends Saturday the 20th, so as this drops, you still have a few days. There have only been about 25 backers thus far. It seems like there could be a lot more, and that could range anywhere from a $5 contribution to a $675 etching that is in the rewards section. There are still plenty of rewards available, from $15 on up to that $675. Eva Georgieva just contributed a collage that is up there, and just prior to that, Rebecca Morris contributed her manifesto posters, which are quite cool. And by the way, graduate students and listeners of this show, there are a few great studio visit opportunities that myself and some people I've spoken to are surprised are not more popular, but they're under $100. Zach Harris, Julian Hober, and Analia Saban, if you can get them to give you a studio visit from whatever your school you're at, you know, go for it. I don't think you're going to have that opportunity. So this is it. I would take it if I were you. And if anybody is interested in a piece and wants to negotiate for a slightly lower price, at least get in touch and we'll see what we can do. All right. Modest contributions, again, are appreciated. So let's go to the Carter Mall episode. Thank you for listening, and just a few more days for that Kickstarter, and I won't be asking for money for a long time. So if you can throw in a little bit, it would be very much appreciated. All right, thank you. This is The Conversation. I am Michael Shaw. Carter Mull is today's episode, and I sat down with him in his studio in downtown Los Angeles, and I think you're going to find this a very satisfying and engaging exchange, at least I did when I listened to it in editing it, and it's particularly heady, pretty wonky compared to a lot of the episodes, but I think nonetheless it'll be a good listen for you. Let me know. Either way, yeah, I think Carter had very thoughtful and smart answers to my questions. I think you're going to agree. So incidentally, after our exchange, we did a screen test, or at least Carter did a screen test, at the end of which he had me join in a singing of the Alphabet song. So I don't know if that's going to be posted or not, but I just want to let you know that happened, and maybe that is enough in case it does not go up, because I was saying some confidential things while he was sitting there saying nothing, so I want to be sure that does not get out there. All right, let's get to that conversation. Now that I've built it up, enjoy, and feel free to comment and go check out past episodes of the show, theconversationpodcast.madewithcolor.com. Perhaps by the time you listen to this, it'll just simply be theconversationpodcast.com. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you later. Okay, well, here's a flash change of subject. Are you named after Jimmy Carter by any chance?
No. Okay. I was born, obviously, during his administration.
Right.
I'm named after a criminal defense lawyer. Or no, excuse me. He was a civil liberties lawyer named Carter something. And he was a Southern lawyer. And my dad, who's a criminal defense lawyer, liked the work this guy did. He liked his style of oration. He liked the type of legal work he did. And so that's what I'm named after.
Right. So you're from Atlanta originally.
Yeah.
So you're from the South, but not really the South. Because were you from a liberal artistic enclave within the city? Is that kind of the way that you put it?
My parents were from the Midwest and moved to Atlanta in 1969 to be involved in the civil rights movement. And both my parents were very politically engaged. as younger people, my dad has remained very politically engaged. And they found themselves in kind of a hippie neighborhood that was basically a kind of like, I don't know, like secure zone in like an otherwise kind of like conservative sort of Dixiecrat is what they call it. Kind of this old version of kind of Democrat that doesn't really exist anymore, but a kind of conservative city. My parents weren't really artistic. They knew a lot about like political subject matter, but not a ton about culture. There was never a big focus.
So where did you start picking? Did you start picking that up then in Atlanta?
On your own? I always, you know, I was one of these people that I made art since, you know, as soon as I basically could. I, you know, probably, I don't know, 3 years old, I assume. And I've just always done it. I fortunately had encouragement from my mom in many ways. If I was sort of making art, I didn't have to do chores, you know? I was, like, allowed to draw on the walls, and so there was that kind of encouragement, and then also she helped me. I was, you know, in contests and stuff like that, and happened to win them, and, you know, so there's sort of various levels of positive encouragement that happened, primarily from my mom, and then also when I got into high school, I had the art. It's kind of ironic. I went to an ex-military school, but it actually had a very good art program, and
So it was an ex-military school before. So it was a military school before you were there.
Yeah,
and then what kind of school was it when you were there?
Kind of conservative
private school.
Yeah, conservative private school. I mean, we wore uniforms, and you know, there was like people were at ROTC and their crenellated walls and stuff. And I mean, it was.
And you were cool with that?
I kind of hated it. It's a
how did the parents that you have wind up sending you to a school like that?
Georgia has a really had, I don't know what the state of it is now, but at the time in the 80s and 90s, it was a really bad public school system. It was like, you know, 47th or something like that of the nation. And so there's, say, 5 really good private schools in the city of Atlanta, and only one of them had been started for. Basically, 4 of them had been started started in response to desegregation in the public school system. So there was a, you know, this kind of process happens. There's desegregation; these private schools merge. The only sort of good private school that was not a result of desegregation was the school that I went to, which happened to be an ex-military school. It had been in existence for, you know, the school was like 100 years old or something by the time I got there. And my dad thought that was politically optimal, you know, that the history of the school was optimal. It wasn't you know, it didn't come from a kind of bad place, even if it came from a kind of problematic military place, right. You know?
Yeah.
So for his politics, that was what was right.
So, were you an Osei? Are you an only child?
Yeah. Okay. I have a stepsister, but I'm an only child.
Yeah. So, I mean, the presumption from all that tension then. Encouragement you're getting from your mom, you know, imply that to me.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
How do you, would you figure that out?
It's a subtext, I think, of what you were saying.
Uh-huh.
You know, you were the star, and, you know, you stayed the star, it sounded like, so.
I think with my mom, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's important, though. I mean, that's important to future stardom, as it turns out. Silence. Okay, so I'm curious, we talked a lot off mic before we started, and, you know, we could retrace some of those things, but I want to talk about, I guess, a big association, and maybe it's sort of a trademark even, with your work is, first of all, the Los Angeles Times, and second of all, you know, this sort of flair, you know, saturation, you know, manipulation. I'm not sure what the best, if there's a good singular term for it, but I mean, you certainly did a series of these LA Times where you, you know, solarized or what have you, them. So I want to talk about that, but also that you were in this MoMA new photographers show. And what's interesting, I think, about that is that there were, I guess, 3 other people in it with you, and their video
interviews with all of them except for you. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's true.
Was that a coincidence? Or?
No.
You refused? You passed?
I thought about it and had a lot of emails with the curator about it, and I don't know if she was annoyed or thought it was interesting or what, but she was cool about it the whole time. And I finally agreed to do it on video, but with a review. And I didn't like the way my image, my visual image, you know, a photographic image of myself, was working online. I thought that the dialogue we had was fine. You know, she asked good questions, the answers, all that was cool. But I was uncomfortable with the presence of, you know, myself, the artist, et cetera, or whatever, in relation to the work. And so I had to kind of...
Did it strike you as a little pretentious, or...?
It's a complex thing for me. I mean, sorry, I was just saying it. My hands are over my face.
Your hands are over your face. It's okay.
It's a complex thing for me. The discussions we had in reading, you know, into the proposal were primarily about the changing role of the artist. And I think you could also say the changing role of the curator.
That's very different then, because I caught, I think, the other three, at least two of the other three, and they seem to be much more specific to the work and the process of the work.
The curator's questions were very, you know, I think focused and concise, and everything was solid there. My questions, these were my questions to the curator sort of prior to the whole process, were about how the web was changing the way that museums broadcast and consequently allowing for, you know, different kind of media reception to happen, and consequently kind of changing the role of the curator and changing the role of the artist. You know, like beforehand, you wouldn't really have this kind of thing be so commonplace. You might have had a video, like you might have a VHS tape or something that would be distributed in a way that might be kind of difficult to get a hold of. And, you know, if you had, like, say, you might have there's many instances of like curators or writers doing walkthroughs with artists of their shows and museums. And that would be on like VHS or film or whatever, but you can't distribute VHS or film quite readily, and there wasn't a huge market for that sort of thing, so that stuff remained archaic. Like, it essentially just ends up in an archive somewhere, a library, or whatever. With the web, it's different, because it's, even though maybe only 1,000 people or 1,200 people would even look at something like that, it still changes on a kind of fundamental level, changes the role of the artist as a kind of public figure, and also changes the role of the curator as a kind of public figure. And that was like the types of questions I was writing in email, like, prior to this whole thing. Like, I don't know if I can do this. This is complicated. Like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with this. Like, and so I finally agreed to do it. And then, I made a mistake and I had to like get out, and then we did a sort of more classic thing with, you know, text transcription, you know?
Well, it's interesting that, because you have this show up now in LA, and one of the images are a couple of your style manipulations from the Pollock movie. And here's this thing of like the artist, you know, as a public figure. So this seems maybe is an ongoing thing with you. But it's interesting because that was what, 8? Was it 2008?
That show is 2009.
2009. So, I mean, even since then, we're already 4 years almost later now, you know, a lot has changed, you know, with museums having, you know, videos of artists. And I think at that time, it was even not that long ago, it was fairly novel.
Yeah, it was to have these videos. The beginning of that.
Yeah. And obviously, there are a large list of pros and cons for doing it, I would imagine. Then, at least. Now, I mean, it's interesting to think about in terms of this podcast. I mean, I don't think many... I mean, there have been a couple of people... There have been several people, I should say, who were worried about how they would sound, you know? And I think even more are worried about talking about things that are too personal, you know, because they don't want to put that out there because they're private or what have you. But... generally, people are like, you know, yeah, I like the attention, you know, and Yeah, I like talking about myself. So, I mean, it's this, I mean, people don't say that, but I mean, that's kind of the built-in thing. And for me, it's, I mean, I'm coming at it from, you know, like imitating this other show in a way, but in another way, it's this niche that, you know, doesn't really exist yet. I mean, very, very, in very small form. And it is contradictory because... It's not contradictory, actually, in a lot of ways. But in some ways, it's contradictory because artists want the work to represent themselves. They don't want to have to be. But on the other hand, I mean, that's part of the job. You know, that's part of the whole spiel era of being an artist, right? I gave you a lot to chew on there, so
yeah,
take
I mean,
your time.
This is a really interesting kind of conversation for me, but because it touches on things that, you know, are obviously like already in my work, you know, like, so your point, you're sort of, that's sort of latent in what you're saying, but you know, I don't know where to kind of begin, frankly. I mean, there's a kind of there's a different type of mediaization. I know that's too sort of brainy of a word or whatever, but like the media has absorbed our social lives in a way that just never really happened before. I mean, you can think of like, you know, I know you talk about the WTF podcast, but I think of this guy, Michael Blackwood, when I think of your project, who made all these movies about artists in the 80s, and they're really fucking great. Like, they're dynamite, like, you know, primary documents of, like, artists talking, you know, and they're hard to get a hold of, and they're when you see them, they're like, wow, this is super special. And that's a certain kind of thing that he was able to do. He was able to make a kind of special dialogue with an artist at the right moment, and, you know, and it just sort of, he's able to work it in the right way. And to me, that is a very niche thing, you know, but that's somehow different than the general experience we have with media now, you know, at circa 2013, but also, I mean, it's been happening for years now in terms of how one's social life is sort of mediated by various technologies, be them softwares or hardwares or whatever. Do you know what I mean? In a way that is so much more substantial than ever before. And I believe it fundamentally changes how we relate to one another. You know, I mean, I remember when, and sort of going back, I remember when I first got a cell phone and how that changed my social life, you know. And so all that's, you know, that's just sort of, I mean, that's a very... That's kind of the tip of the iceberg. Do you know what I mean? Because it's obviously a much more complex question than that. I mean, being mediated kills people. You know what I mean? It literally leads people to, like, serious drug abuse, suicide. They call it in Hollywood, like, death through misadventure. You know what I mean? It literally will take a person's life. That form of celebrity doesn't really happen in art. You know, even, like, you know, Gerhard Richter, someone who's now kind of celebrity... It's not even substantial.
Well, you know,
it's not substantial in the way that, you know.
Well, you know the line that the beloved Julian Schnabel had, which hasn't been repeated that often, despite its greatness, is, you know, compared to Burt Reynolds, you know, what artist is famous?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
but you know, I'm glad you helped me sort of clarify a way of talking about what we're doing, because I am very averse to the idea of being considered the media. I mean, I am not the media. I would say that the curator that you had this, you know, back and forth with and ultimately sort of, you know, went in these couple of directions, she's not the media per se, but in the context, she kind of become, you know, she's in essence or a journalist of sorts. In that context.
We both, I think what's problematic is not that one side or the other does it. It's not that the institution is doing it to the artist or vice versa. It's that we both become that. Do you know what I mean? We both become a kind of public voice in a way that wasn't necessarily there across the board, and also may hit certain sort of buttons for certain practices. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm, you know, maybe one of a handful of artists that maybe worries about this kind of stuff or thinks about this kind of stuff. It's also particular to what I do every day. You know what I mean? And for some artists, I'm sure they're like, whatever, like, oh, you know, it's no big deal. Like, it's not, it doesn't affect the project. It's just it's just part of the job, like you're saying. For me, it was actually became a much more complex thing, you know. And I think it was, for me, it was like a across-the-board kind of thing that was happening. It wasn't like, you know, the fact that the Museum of Modern Art had decided to do this was, you know, nobody's fault or nobody's brilliance. It was a thing that was happening across the board. It was a type of transformation that was happening across the board. You know?
Well, what about the MoMA, the new photography show at MoMA in the first place? I mean, that is obviously, for a Los Angeles artist, a really big deal. And how did it come about? You know, was it surprising at all?
I had been in a kind of dialogue with the curator for a couple years. She had...
what's her name?
Ava Raspini. She had noticed my work at a certain point, and we kind of stayed in touch. And, you know, I was excited about the show. I thought she did a really good job with it. And it's an interesting thing because you're right. I mean, in terms of, you know, how Los Angeles kind of functions on the global map of art, it, you know, is maybe a kind of walled city, has a kind of autonomy, or you could even call it provincial, you know. And that's kind of changing, or sort of ever-changing, or, you know, ever-growing or something. But nevertheless, that's, you know, it has that position. And so, and then something like the Museum of Modern Art has a much greater position in terms of its ability to broadcast. So even greater than a New York gallery, which would also get a lot of traffic. You know, I think, you know, I don't know the actual numbers, but it's something like, you know, there's like a couple hundred thousand people that walk through the museum, like, every cycle of exhibitions, every 3 months or whatever, you know. And so when you're in a show there, be it a collection show, which was recently in, or, you know, a more focused show with fewer people in it.
Which is what you were.
I mean, I've been in a couple shows there now, but
that
was the first one. And people end up seeing, like, just, and when I'm talking about people, it's like, they're people that you're never, ever, ever going to meet. They're not necessarily, like, high-level people in the art world or anything like that you'll meet and talk to because you're going to do work with them or something. They're just, like, a much more general segment of the population goes there, you know? So in that regard, it is really interesting because it does... it's a very different kind of place to show work in that regard. I mean...
So you're totally glossing over the sort of spectacular, you know, opportunity / you know, a milestone kind of event of it.
Well, yeah, but I don't see it that way. I mean, you seem to see it that way. I don't see it that way. I mean, I feel like, you know, I've been in a handful of shows that I like. I feel like other people probably say the same thing. It's like, for better or for worse, I don't love every group show that I'm in, you know? And that was a group show that I liked, you know? So I sort of remember it as, like, a good group show in this certain site. You know, there's been other good group shows, too, you know? And I hope there are more. I mean, I think, for me, with that show, where that show kind of took my thinking, and I think this is something that definitely, I think maybe we talked about, it's something I definitely talk about with people, is how the question of medium frames practices. You know, so when you're in a show that's called New Photography, even if the show is actually wrestling with questions about the transformation of photography, it still ends up sort of creating this sort of box, you know, a kind of framework for the reception of the work. You know, there's a text literally imposed upon the work.
Yeah.
You know, so New Photography gets imposed upon the work or whatever. And that was actually something that was, like, way more on my mind, you know, because my work doesn't cleanly fit into such a category, you know. And so that was something I spent a lot of time considering and talking about and kind of working through. And
but you would have been a fool to see that as, you know, too overwhelming a burden to bear to be in the show at MoMA.
No, it's not a burden. It's a good thing. It's like, I just, you know, as an artist, it's like a, you know, you sort of learn on the job, you know? And it was definitely like sort of on the job learning for me in a really good way. Like, for example, like, you know, there's a sort of person that curates the show, but then there's a team in the department, and they all are kind of around and have different kind of roles and do different work depending on what the show is. And so one of the curators in the team came up to me, like, during the installation process, like, in a casual social situation, but still kind of in that time before the show. It was like, look, we don't think you're going to continue to make photographs, but we've decided to put you in this show anyways. They're like, we're supportive of what you're doing. And they're like, in the past, we've put people that have gone on to be known as sculptors or be known as installation artists or whatever they get known as. And she's like, we think that's probably going to happen with you, but we wanted to put you in the show anyways. And it was like, at that actual time, like that literal moment, I was like, I didn't know if I was like being like insulted or like, it was like a diss or something, like in some like really like smooth way or something.
What was this woman's position who said this to you?
It was like curator, like one of the curators.
One of the main curators.
Totally good, like, position. Like, and like, honestly, like, she was right. Like, just like way more prescient than I was about my own work. Do you know what I mean? And so that's actually like a special thing. You know what I mean? Like, in a way, like, I guess it depends how you take it, but I took it as like kind of like what / you blew my mind / like thank you. You know what I mean? Like, because it ended up being true, and it ended up giving me somebody to chew on.
So several years later, or you at the time?
I mean, you've sort of been to the studio. Like, I basically, like, draw my way through making photographs anyways. And, so, like, and,
How long has that been going on?
Really overtly since 2005. But, there was a kind of window when it didn't do that, but I'd been doing that prior from, like, a youth till, say, 2001 or so.
Okay.
Just for everything that I do.
Right. Well, before you go on, because I just want to interject that I was actually, and maybe because I wasn't aware of this longer arc that you're speaking of, but I was a little surprised with this current show that you have, because you have a number of sort of gouache / mixed medium pieces, you know, and
yeah.
You just have a few of the C prints, you know, whereas in the last couple of shows, if I understand right, you just had C prints. So... Are you aware of a perception that is like of a change from others now?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, kind of like we're sort of, there's a sort of public life to a practice, you know, and a private life to a practice, and sometimes those things join up like really perfectly, and that's great, and sometimes they don't join up, and that's also optimal, you know? So in my work, I had shown some drawings in a show at Gavin Brown's Enterprise Passerby space in 2006, I think. It might have been early 2007, but it was like 2006. And it was a suite of 36 drawings, and I think like 18 of them were on the wall. And it was in a group show organized by an artist named Darren Bader. And so the show was kind of a complex hang of work. Like, you wouldn't necessarily, like, see everything super clearly. It wasn't a kind of typical show in the way things were put together. So I'd shown drawings at that point. And I'd been drawing consistently. But I didn't show drawings again until 2010. So it was like a year after the MoMA show. And at that point, I only showed one drawing. And then there were maybe like 7 C prints in the room, you know. So I think most people just walked into a gallery who saw the show and were like, oh, photographs, new photography, Carter Mall photographs, you know what I mean? And just click, you know, it was sort of like, you know, business as usual in a way. And so with this show, like, one thing that I wanted to do in terms of, like, the public reception and presentation of my work was to simply kind of be like, okay, look, there's drawings, and they're photographs, and they're on the wall, and they exist in the same space, and this is my practice. The truth of the matter is there's a much more complex picture of what I do is actually kind of going on in the studio. Things are in the works, etc. And I think people who are really familiar with my work maybe understand those intricacies. But I think by and large, not, you know? So I think with this show that's up right now with the guy in Los Angeles, Mark Fox, it was simply kind of like a kind of laying claim to the fact that, like, yes, okay, here it is, drawings, photographs, you know what I mean? And there's also a slideshow, and there's also, you know, an object that has the sound component to it as well. Just simply, it was like, okay, here it is, you know? And I guess that's my hope, my personal hope, that people will get a kind of meatier sense of my practice and be able to know it in a kind of richer way, you know? Because one of those things about those boxes that artists get put in is they can be, like, really, really helpful to people if they're sort of, like, super accurate, but not every practice. In fact, most practices don't fit really cleanly into those kind of boxes, you know? And so one of the things I've been just sort of trying to do with my own work is to kind of allow people to see it for what it is and consequently kind of make a kind of box or, you know, contextual framework or whatever that's more accurate to what I actually do.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a case of ambition that would cause people to worry, you know, that, hey, don't box me into this, you know, because I'm more complicated than that. You know what I mean?
There's got to be an example outside of art, like what that would be. Like, there's got to be an anecdote for that. Like,
yeah, right. Okay,
well, I mean, that's got to be like a human thing.
We'll have to think about that in the back of our heads as we go on.
Okay.
Who's the model dude that you have in that sort of slideshow, by the way, that you have in the show?
That is a, he refers to himself as a porn performer.
Okay.
His stage name is Ryan Driller. I met him through pretty straightforward means. Like, I did a lot of research, talked to a number of agents in that world, in the porn world, and kind of decided to work with this guy and see if it would work. And it turned out that it did. It was kind of a risk. And it turned out that it worked. He's a delightfully nice person, like truly kind human being.
Well, that's good on a practical level. But yeah. You decided in your head you needed sort of a model-like presence to be, you know, performing, as it were, in this piece.
I wanted someone in the entertainment business.
Is that because you have director ambitions?
I don't think so. Who knows? But that's not a thought that crosses my mind a lot. I wanted someone in the entertainment business because the show is constructed around this kind of collision of entertainment and artistic production, and so
sure.
It's just like the sensible. I just wanted a kind of a clear thing in that regard. I'd been reading about there have been a couple things that kind of collided in that piece. Like, I'd been reading about essentially a kind of critique of entertainment media in the United States, a kind of political critique written. I can't remember the name of the guy. It's like one of these sort of New York Times ebooks. That the guy had worked for the New York Times for years and was in Bosnia and Serbia in the 90s and stuff, and then decided to, like, focus on America in his older age. And so he wrote a lot about pornography and about kind of the psychological problems that a lot of porn performers get into.
Okay.
Fair amount of drug use, specifically painkillers, and a lot of, like, alcohol abuse. And I was interested in that because, you know, the show, the sort of, you know, you have, like, Michael Jackson and Anna Nicole Smith and, you know, Jackson Pollock, and these figures that passed away through, you know, some kind of combination of, like, car wreck, you know, some sort of weird drug thing, or some kind, you know, usually kind of combination of factors.
Yeah.
And so it seemed like the sort of porn industry was kind of like maybe a place to kind of focus sort of the research, you know, as opposed to, say, find budding starlet, which would be super easy to do. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you know, in Los Angeles. It's an easy thing to figure out. And so I wanted someone in pornography for that reason. And I also wanted, I wanted to make cheesecake pictures.
And you also wanted a male as opposed to a female, which yeah. would also be have been more traditional, as it were. Is that true, too?
That
you chose a male versus a starlet, as you said before?
Yeah. But why would that... I'm confused. Well,
you said, you know, you could have easily gone the starlet route, you know.
Yeah.
But you chose to go the porn route. So I'm saying, even within the porn route, you chose to go male rather than female.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, that's true. I mean, when you do this research, you'll see that, like, you know, there'll be 20 guys and 300 women repped by these agencies. I mean, that's... I don't know what the actual breakdown is, but it's super heavy towards women. You're totally right.
Yeah.
I was thinking, like... I was, like... You know, I was just thinking about cheesecake photographs. I was thinking about, like, this sort of...
Anti-cheesecake photographs, right? Because you got this ill-fitting wig on him and half-dressed and whatnot.
But it's... But they're, like... But sort of the... You know, the... I mean, maybe we're kind of trying to figure out what the definition of a cheesecake photograph is or something. But, like, there's this thing about that where it's like the half-clothed, like... kind of sexy, not really sexy, you know, kind of a not pornographic per se, but kind of sexy, you know.
It seems like that in retrospect, having seen it, that you are subverting the, you know, more titillating elements of the cheesecake.
Yeah.
Shtick.
Yeah, I mean, sort of the larger, it's, you know, the dominant thing in that, to talk about that work is to talk about the model in the slideshow, because that's the buzzy thing that we wrap our heads around. But the truth of the matter is it only really makes sense if you sort of see the text and see it in context. You know, and the text, you know, sort of the climax, so to speak, in the text is this line, like so much cheese for the dogs, or sometimes we would say like gravy for the dogs. And that's actually what propelled, I mean, I was trying to create like a stupid pun, like, cheesecake, like just, you know, super simple kind of relationship. And that sort of brought up, that sort of built the idea into, you know, where it went. And so that text is, that's another thing altogether. You know, that so in a way there's a couple of different things that kind of collide in that piece. And for me it was sort of the reason I kind of allowed, I mean that's often with my work that many ideas will kind of collide, but for me the kind of thing that sort of holds that piece together is a play with the question of desire, you know. And I suppose, like, you know, Ryan Driller is more desirable to some people than to others. Do you know what I mean? Nevertheless, I sort of wanted to play with that question.
You know? Okay. So you lived in New York for a certain amount of time?
Yeah, for about 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was this like after school or?
Yeah, I went to RISD and I finished in 2000 and then I moved to New York. I lived there till the summer of 2004.
Okay. And so what was going on?
You were
beginning your exploration of mainly photography, or
yeah, in my work that's what was going on. I had I guess when I first moved to New York, I was still making paintings.
Is that what you did in school?
Yeah, I kind of discovered the camera at the end of my time in undergrad, and but up to that point, I primarily made paintings. I mean, I made books, I made videos, I made sculptures and performances. Like, I kind of did everything, but I was primarily making paintings and drawings. And I came up, you know, I started making photographs. And when I mean making photographs, like making things that I sort of put, you know, on the wall, so to speak. I mean, it always made snapshots or used cameras or whatever. You know what I mean? But in terms of actually, like, saying, like, okay, I'll show this, you know, and as much as I would show a painting that I made. You know, for me, that was sort of the first time I'd really made photographs. And that was in my last year in school. And so when I got out, I was, like, kind of trying to figure out. It was kind of a breakthrough that happened right at the end of school. Like, it was my thesis show, but I think I'd made you know, and basically the last, say, 3 or 4 months of school is when it happened. And when I moved to New York, I was, like, trying to figure out what that breakthrough was, you know, because it had happened, and I was trying to make sense of it. And so at that time of making sense of it, I was still making paintings, making some photographs, and also working on the computer a lot. And that was the first time I really started doing that. I was teaching myself Photoshop and teaching myself...
So you didn't do that at RISD?
No. I was teaching myself, like, Quark and what stuff that was used at that time.
You know? Yeah. So what... How did it come to be a four-year tenure in New York?
Well, while I was there, I worked through a job I had. I worked with this guy named Larry LeMay, who's people in New York, you know, some people kind of know this guy, sort of known figure in a weird way, in a way that you can be in New York. You know, you're going to be famous for just being yourself, you know?
What was he famous for?
He's famous for a really great haircut, kind of like a bowl cut, like dyed red hair, and he always wears 3-piece suits, like even in the summer and stuff, and he... he's a noise musician who made a living documenting art, primarily sculpture. So he...
at galleries?
Yeah, for galleries and for artists, but mostly for galleries. So he would, you know, photograph Matthew Barney's sculpture. You know, like, he's the only guy Matthew really ever wanted to use because he liked the way that he documented the work, you know. And so I would hang out with Larry... Larry would always work at night. He would sleep till, like, you know, after lunch, basically. And then he'd wake up, and then he would, you know, come by whatever gallery he was working at, like, 4 or 5, maybe take care of business, and then start working after the gallery would close. And so I would hang out with him while he would work.
But you weren't working for him?
No.
Okay.
No, and I just kind of help him out. And that's basically, like, how I learned to use cameras. You know, I'd always, like, known how to use a 35mm camera, but I never knew how to use 4x5s or...
So he was shooting 4x5?
Yeah, he was shooting 4x5 at the time and 8x10 sometimes. And he was a super, like, tech guy. Like, he knew... I mean, part of the musician thing in him was, like, a technical thing, and so he knew a lot about, like, how to make things and how to kind of tweak things and stuff. And so I essentially learned how to... like do all that stuff from just like hanging out with him and why he would photograph sculpture.
And sounds like a great internship.
Yeah, it was really good. And we still kind of in touch. Like when I go to New York, I'll see him sometimes. And we've tried to do stuff together, but he's like, it's kind of flaky, you know? So, but he's great. He's done, I mean, he's, everyone kind of knows him and sort of knows that he's, you know, sort of a good dude. But
yeah,
so sort of doing that and kind of teaching myself and then like, you know, just going out a lot. Sort of what you do in New York when you're young, you know. And that was like my New York life, and I kind of needed to get out. I needed something more.
Can you think of a turning point when you kind of said, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to go to graduate school, and the reason I wanted to go was I felt like there was something. I'd always had this feeling ever since I got to college that there was like something missing in my education, you know, and so like. When I was at RISD as an undergrad, I literally go to the library like 3 hours a day, you know? I go to class and then like it'd be, you know, quitting time or whatever, and I'd go to the library and like just hang out and read and stuff. And I was like, and I thought about transferring, and it was sort of like, I liked school there and I liked my classes, I liked the people there, but it was sort of like tormented by the type of education I was getting. And I always wanted to be more, you know?
Because it wasn't... theory oriented enough.
Yes, basically. I mean, that's essentially, it didn't necessarily need to be theory, but that's essentially how that usually breaks down in art education. It could have been sociology. It could have been a number of different ways of teaching about other parts of life besides sort of the making of art, you know?
Yeah.
The production of art.
Yeah.
And, I would still even kind of argue that RISD still needs more of that, you know? And I definitely felt that as a student. And I felt that because I needed something more. I needed something more on my mind to kind of nurture my work, you know? It wasn't... For me, art making is not simply kind of like, you know, rolling up your sleeves and making something. You know, I don't really... To me, that's craft, you know? That's not what art is, you know? And I always needed something more. And so that's... And sort of graduate school is like my solution for that.
Right, right. Yeah. Which was where?
CalArts.
Okay.
I think if anything, that was like maybe the beginning of a kind of intellectual thing process for me. I mean, there had been some latent version of that, but CalArts, and I think graduate school for most people is like a kind of catalyzing experience. It's not necessarily that the school gives you the total package of what you need. It's more like it maybe kind of gets the gears turning in a certain way, and that continues, you know.
Was UCLA on your radar when you were considering?
Yeah, yeah.
We've got a story, folks.
Well, I tried to give you like your juicy anecdotes.
Please.
You know? So
yes, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, UCLA was on my radar. We talked about, you know, earlier, and sort of I've talked about in the past, but James Welling is an important person for me, you know, especially in photography. Like, when I was even in New York and trying to wrap my brain around what I was doing, because I was doing something that didn't look like anything else. It looked very strange at the time. I mean, now it looks kind of normal, but my work actually looked quite strange in 2002, you know. And I was looking for, like, you know, things in the world that I could kind of like connect with, basically. And so Welling's work was like essentially the only thing I really found in like the sort of, you know, subsection of art called photography that clicked, you know. There were things like other things, Sigmar Polkar or whatever, like painters that definitely made sense for me, but in terms of like people that were sort of more made, you know, prints of sorts, Jim was the one. And so I wanted to go to UCLA and work with him. You know, like, sort of, those sort of, like, the logical thing. Like, oh, you know, I like this work, I'll go there. And, like, sort of, like, how most students think. And so, anyways, I ended up going to CalArts. And when I...
So, wait. Well, you skipped over a part. So why didn't you end up working with Jim at UCLA?
Well, when I finished CalArts... I moved to Los Angeles. That was the reason I moved out here, was to go to graduate school. And right when I moved out here, I got Jim's email address from somebody... I can't remember who. I think it was like an old friend of his that I happened to meet. And I wrote him like a fan mail, you know, like, hey, you're awesome. Like, can we meet, you know? And so we met and I showed him my work and he had some criticisms and he had some appreciations and he showed me what he was working on. He was working on this interesting thing with Maya at the time. It's a 3D modeling program. And I don't know where that went exactly. It'll probably surface again in his work. But, it was a nice interaction. We kind of kept in touch, you know. And then when I got out of school, like sort of the first, that September, like that next semester, Jim asked me to speak in his class about my work. So I went, you know, it was like an undergrad class at UCLA, and I gave...
And how long out of grad school were you at this point?
3 months or something. You know? So, like, I walk into class and I do my, you know, I think I did PowerPoint. It was sort of like, you know, I guess people were doing PowerPoint then.
Sure.
And I did my whole thing and I talked and, you know, showed my slides and showed the development of my work and whatever. And their questions and all this. And sort of at the end, Jim was like, did you apply to UCLA? And I was like, yeah, I did. And he's like, did you apply to enroll in 2004? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, we accepted Patterson over you. And he was like, that was a mistake.
Wow. Oh, it's on the record, folks. Don't ask me to take that out.
There's your juicy anecdote.
Thank you. That's Patterson Beckwith, correct?
Patterson, yeah.
Well, that's quite a thing for him to confess.
Made me feel good.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's a compromise. It's like we didn't let you in, but we should have.
You never know. I mean, you never know when you're on those, like, what do they call them? Like
committees?
Yeah, like application committee or whatever.
Sure.
Like, you never know. You're looking at these slides and, like, you don't know if this kid's, like, a stoner who, like, wrote a good essay or, like, what,
well,
you know?
So there was only one spot for a photographer?
They did two spots. So Alex Klein, who you probably know.
The name rings a bell.
She does a lot of interesting work. Right now, she's at the ICA Philadelphia. She does artwork. She does curatorial work. She's a writer. She has a publishing imprint called Oslo Editions. She was the other person in the program at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have an interesting, in all seriousness now, I have an interesting question about James Welling's work, because you had just mentioned about 10 minutes before that, how, you know, this whole rolling up your sleeves mentality, you know, that you were sort of suggested that can, you know, just doing the work is kind of just craft. it seems like, I mean, his work is pretty good representation of kind of a rolling up your sleeves. You know, maybe it's in an experimental way, but I mean, there's a very heavy process-based side of it. And, you know, I just, you know, I totally get, you know, the sort of the importance of having ambition that, you know, makes one's work have an interior slash background life, you know, that is invested into whatever kind of process or craft it is, you know, and how, you know, there is just craft and then there's art. But I think, I feel like when you said, you know, this digging up your sleeves thing, and then you started talking about James Welling, and we were talking about his work earlier, you know, I think there's a real strong connection there. I wanted to see if you agree with me.
Yeah, I mean, I have my ideas about, you know, what Jim is doing, and I mean, other people do too. There's a lot of writing about it. Like, you can fully do the research. I mean, the research is out there. I mean, I think sometimes there's a confusion about process and labor, you know? Two different things, you know what I mean? I mean, in many ways, you can kind of farm the labor out. You know, I mean, you can have elves do it, or you can have fabricators do it, or there's any number of ways to kind of farm the labor out. Process is, I think, something that is not simply craft, but is also, can be the kind of thinking through of something. I mean, it can be a cognitive process as much as it can be a material process. And I think in many cases, for, like, most artists, I think, who are, like, you know, really doing something like that, those things are intertwined, you know? It's like the sort of in cognitive science, there's like this kind of like, you know, you think with your body kind of thing. You know, some people gesticulate, or some people walk around, or like, you know, there's a way in which like physical sensations, some people take a shower to have ideas or whatever, you know? It's the way that like physical sensations
that's
like,
a good, that's a good image. Yeah, like that image, the shower, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you're in the shower. I mean, it's happened to me a lot lately. I'm in the shower, and it's like, maybe I should have, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Because it's like, it's a tactile thing.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to labor too much on that. I do, speaking of him, James Welling, though, again, as I was thinking about you going in to give a lecture 3 months after you had basically finished grad school, that maybe that was that, perhaps in retrospect, a little bit like he was giving to you kind of the encouragement that your mom kind of had given you as a young child, perhaps?
I mean, that's like the most kind, like, coolest thing anyone could do, you know? I'm not sure. You know, I can't say. I mean, I like the fact that you would say that. I think it's a very, like, positive, healthy thing to think. I have no idea, you know? I mean, I have no idea.
Okay, well, it was also a kind of a precursor to wondering sort of if there was I'm going to anticipate that the answer to this question is, you know, that it was a gradual thing. You know, like the way that people talk about artist careers, you know, it's this gradual thing. You know, it's not like all of a sudden overnight, you know, everything changes. You know, it's like this slow building.
Yeah.
You know, you get a review here. You you know, you have an extra show there, etc. But I'm curious with you not getting into UCLA, but then going to Cal Arts, having, you know, doing this lecture right out of school. Was there a particular point, you know, because that wasn't that long ago in a sense, but it kind of was in a way, to contradict myself. Was there a point where things really heated up particularly for you, would you say?
You mean like in terms of like the reception of my work?
So the reception of your work slash, you know, it becoming a full-time job.
I mean, it's an interesting question, because I think the answer is like, the common sense answer of that is like super deceiving to like what most people think, you know?
Sure.
And what even I thought until sort of things started happening in a way. I honestly would say I experienced a kind of waxing and waning with that kind of thing. And, but like also kind of consistency. I mean, maybe I'm lucky to have a kind of consistency. Do you know what I mean? Like there's always like, you know, this many group shows, and there's, you know what I mean? There's always, you know, it sort of always kind of works out in this way, you know? But in a way, like in terms of like heat, like when, like, you can kind of, like, it sounds really corny, but when you can kind of, like, feel that you're being watched, you know? And maybe that sounds corny to normal people because that sounds a cult or something, but I think if you're, like, really in touch with, like, a community or a culture, to sort of depending on how you want to talk about it in a way, you can kind of feel it, you know? And so that waxes and wanes, like, how much kind of heat there is waxes and wanes. And so I think, and then, of course, that part is a two-way street, and that's the complex part. Like, when you feel the heat, you can act, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know what I mean? So it's like, and I think that's what most people do, you know? In my case, I did something a little unusual, like, or maybe counter-logical. I don't know. I did something that people wouldn't necessarily do. I actually probably had more heat as a graduate student and right out of graduate school than I did for, say, I don't know, 3 years after that? Like, 2 or 3 years? I think what happened to me is, you know, I was a funny case in the sense that I moved from New York and I was kind of student of art history, like a sort of autodidact sort of student, and sort of spent a lot of time collecting books and looking at books and reading about things, reading magazines and stuff. And when I moved to Los Angeles and was in graduate school and was showing my work as a graduate student, I worked with a gallery before I started graduate school.
Where was that?
A gallery called Rivington Arms in New York.
So that was already a fairly high-profile situation.
At that time, that was a high-profile situation due to kind of how New York works. You know, there was sort of a spotlight on that gallery at that moment, you know. And
now, how did you, just sort of the quick version of how you came to have a relationship with them?
Since
you were out of school.
I had friends that worked with them. So there was a artist named Jonah Capel who did a super, what I thought was a super dynamite show with them. And I also thought it was a kind of prescient show. Like, I thought it was way ahead of the curve, like substantially ahead of the curve. He did a show with them he did two shows. And I think the one that I really responded to was the second one. And that was, can't remember when that was. So let's just say 2002. I can't really remember when it was. But we had a kind of reciprocity at that time, positive exchange. Like, I was into what he was doing. He was into what I was doing. And there was a kind of mutual encouragement going on. And so he, like, really coolly, like, talked to the gallerists about my work. And I think he, like, was like, look, you gotta look at this. You know, and I think right. At first they're like, whatever, you know, like, why are we gonna look at this? Like, well, you're telling us to look at it. Why should we look at it? You know what I mean? Like,
but isn't that the classic artist recommendation sort of dynamic?
I think it's a lot more complex than that, actually. I think
he had done this great show with them. They presumably thought so. So he's giving them a recommendation. I don't know why they would then in turn be resistant to his suggestion.
Well, they might be resistant to his suggestion because they would rather discover the artist than he. You know, like, they might want to have that in their cultural belt notched ahead of him, you know.
But I've heard dealers say, you know, it's all about the artist. Well, I've heard collectors say
that. I think it depends who you're talking to.
Sure.
I think it really depends on the gallerist. Like, sure. So it depends what the cultural project of the gallerist is.
Got it.
Anyways, over time, you know, took some time, as it always does, organically, I ended up getting into a dialogue with Mirabel and Melissa, who are the gallerists, and that dialogue led to studio visits and numerous studio visits, and that led to, they saw the work kind of progress and grow, and as the work progressed and grew, I think they also grew in their excitement for it, I would presume, and it led to us doing a show together, you know, and working together. And that all happened before I was in graduate school, you know. I actually made my first solo show, from my CalArt studio, you know. And
so you were doing a very UCLA kind of thing, as it turned
out. Exactly. And so thank you, because that's sort of losing my train of thought there. So I kind of realized this. I think a friend had told me about that, and I kind of loosely knew about it, because you kind of, there was like a New York Times Magazine article about UCLA in, say, 2000 or so. You know, sort of an, it was big. It's widely known that UCLA was like producing people that were going into,
yeah,
you know, sort of the system pretty quickly. And I started like researching that, like people that had passed through UCLA primarily in the 90s. What was happening to them as graduate students, what was happening to them right afterwards, what was happening to them in 2005, like, which is the year those were, you know, those were tracking their histories, you know, and doing so to teach myself something, you know, and all that said, like, what, so this first show I did with Mirabel and Melissa was well received, and was written about in the New Yorker, and reviewed, and whatnot, and a museum bought the work, and then I did a thesis show in my second year, and through various circumstances, a different museum also bought work from my thesis show. And so I found myself in this position of having, like, heat, basically, you know.
Tremendous heat.
Yeah. So like, at that moment, it's like, well, do you just, like, go for it? Or do you, like, you know, like in the South, they would say, like, lay back in the cut, you know, like, and so
what does that mean?
It's like, laying back in the cut is like when you sit on the couch at the party and just, like, watch the party, you know. I basically decided to, like, not, you know, it just didn't seem to make sense for me to kind of, like, push that heat. And part of it was, honestly, like, there were a lot of things that happened to me as a graduate student. Like, I discovered aspects of my project that, like, I wouldn't have otherwise, you know. And also as a graduate student, even though I was showing and stuff, I was actually really trying to, like, have the educational experience of graduate school. I was, like, trying to push and grow my work at the same time, you know. And so because of that, like, I found myself in a situation where I wanted to, like, let the work develop more, you know, as opposed to put myself in a situation where I might kind of be branding out something and then get caught in the kind of the problems of that, et cetera, and whatever.
That, yeah, that's sounds really precocious in a way. But funnily enough, it takes me back to kind of where I sort of introduced things with you at the beginning, which was this LA Times, you know, that phase, if you will, of your work. And I just wonder if you would cop to or cognizant of that phase or that style of element of your work being part of your brand, if you will, or part of a signature, or if it's something you, like, want to fervently avoid because it's kind of that box thing.
No, it's, I mean, I know what you mean, but, I'll probably give you like a 10-minute answer.
Right.
Yeah, like,
well, well, yeah, that's a good anticipation. What I was going to interject with as you were thinking about your answer is I was going to take the pros stance of that, which is, you know, and it may feed into my perception of, you know, of using those kinds of terms. There's something very you know, it's like the solarization. In the process kind of becomes the solarization in the memory. In other words, they have a certain kind of visual impact that stays with you. And so I guess the point is, you know, even though you would perhaps on certain parts of you would prefer not to be reduced down, you know, to that being your brand, there's a intensity, you know, intense memory connectedness for viewers with that phase,
yeah,
that, you know, is important.
Yeah. No, totally. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I'm kind of in the midst of sorting through that. I mean, one of the reasons, this is kind of digression, but hopefully it answers your question. One of the reasons I was, like, driven to make drawings, like, also show drawings, is I needed a kind of way to, like alleviate something from my work. Like, I needed, like a valve that I could open and, like, steam would sort of pop out in another direction. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just needed, because there's sort of more going on, like, what I was doing than sort of those Los Angeles Times photographs could kind of handle. Do you know what I mean? And so the drawings kind of do that, even though they have some degree of complexity and there's a whole conversation there. In many regards, they're simpler than the Los Angeles Times photographs, you know? That was, like, necessary for me. And then sort of the other sort of thing I wanted to say is that I haven't, until this show, I haven't made a photograph for, like, about a year and a half. You know, I made these two recent photographs for the show. And I'm now, like, excited again about making photos. But I'd kind of, like, hit a certain wall in relationship to the kind of demands placed on me.
Let me interrupt you there, because that sort of goes back to the question I was asking earlier about when things started to change. So there must have been, you know, a certain condensed period where all of a sudden you realized that, you know, there was a demand being placed upon you. Can you put your finger on when that was?
I mean, honestly, you know, if you want to sort of talk structurally about the art world, like, the MoMA show probably led to that. You know, it's like, it's those things that, it's kind of how the system works, you know. But it literally happens to, like, every artist, you know, unless the artist, like, I will say it happens to every artist. You just said, and what happens is you're asked to produce for the sake of producing. You know what I mean? And this will happen to the most rarefied cases. I would even say it probably happens to Michael Asher. It happened to Michael Asher, who I think has had a sort of perfect career in a weird way. I mean, he could, because there were certain things that allowed for that. But,
yeah,
you know, even, like, he would have been sort of, you know, requests come in and, you know, you're sort of asked to produce, and they're good requests from good people, and you don't want to say no, and they make sense. So you get into this position, you know, and it's really important how you handle that position. I think it's important for every artist. And I guess I found myself in that position where I just couldn't sort of do it in a way that I wanted to without having other kind of outlets in the work. Do you know what I mean? So, like, for me, like, what's kind of happened in the work is that I started to kind of, after, like, through the MoMA show and through the thinking about being boxed in a photo place and all that kind of stuff, I started to think really intensely about that question of mediums. You know, so the box is medium X or whatever, like what the hell is a medium? What's the history of this? What's the history of museums doing this? Like, does this fucking mean anything? Like, so this is an antiquated idea that doesn't make sense in 2012 or 2013, you know? And so for me, like, I sort of kind of come to a place where, like, I don't see huge differences between most rectangles, two-dimensional rectangles on walls. Like, I just sort of lost, there's sort of a distinction that I've kind of lost there. And there's, I do see material and structural distinctions, you know, between, say, the difference between a camera-intensive Type C print versus a computer-intensive inkjet print or a gouache and ink-intensive. You know what I mean? There are differences there. But for me, it started to be like, well, what's, like, I can just make a painting if I want to. You know, I can make a huge watercolor. I can make a huge drawing. I can make, you know what I mean? Because I started to just see these differences collapse in front of me. And so in a way, that was also like an answer to this question that I was sort of, this sort of structural force that was being put onto me. Do you know what I mean? And like, so, you know, it caused like a period of not making photographs, but now I'm sort of sorting through that stuff, and I'm actually like getting really excited about making photographs again and making drawings and making other things. And it sounds so corny to kind of like talk about as like rectangles on walls, but like, you know, it's like, honestly, it's like it's a fucking,
it sounds format. Reductive.
It's
actually,
it's a reductive thing. But what happens is it sort of breaks down this notion of medium into this, like, what I think people maybe talk about as format, you know, that's maybe a kind of more general situation. You know, medium is maybe a more specific situation, you know, but I also think there's another layer to this, which is that, you know, digitization in photography was essentially a collapse of a number of different things, and then photography kind of picked it up. You know, Photoshop wasn't really designed solely for photography, and it was definitely not designed solely for art photography. Do you know what I mean? And then, like, the Adobe family of softwares, the primary market is, you know, visual commercial production. You know, it happened that art photography kind of picked up on it, you know? And so there was a kind of collapse. It was kind of built into the technological transformation that we've all experienced, you know? Which was also a kind of solution, you know?
So speaking of Photoshop, what's your big tool? What's your, you know, what was the big tool in the toolbox that you were using, you know, for the photographs that I was referring to earlier?
Oh,
or is it a little silly to narrow it down?
No, totally. I use adjustment layers. You know, I use all sorts of adjustment layers.
Got it. Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, totally.
Thank you for talking to me.
Yeah, totally. Good to talk to you.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And we're out.